Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. The sun is yellow, Sirius is blue, and good grief, the sky is too. I like listening to the voice of the universe, Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Comet Watch. Hello and welcome to Comet Watch. Now, we did actually record the show on June 5th, but we had a slight error with one of our first part of the recording, so we're going to do it again. So, myself and Neil Norman are going to get that fixed. So, here we go. On April 26, WOTOP Boompod reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On April the 30th, WOTOP Boompod reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
May the 1st, WOTOP Boompod reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On May the 2nd, WOTOP Boompod reported a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On May the 3rd, WOTOP Boompod reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On the 7th of May, BOZU reported a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On May the 8th, discovery of 2016 J1 Pan-STARRS announced.
May the 8th also, the discovery of 2016 J2 Dennu was announced.
May 13th, Mikhail Khrushchev reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On May the 14th, Masanori Uchina reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
May the 15th, WOTOP Boompod reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On May the 15th also, Sergei Shupakov reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On May the 17th, WOTOP Boompod reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
Also on May the 17th, Michael Kuziak reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On May the 20th, Tagriv Pestergaard reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
Again on May the 20th, Simon Liu reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
Again on May the 20th, Sesmon Liwu reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On May the 21st, Sergei Shupakov reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On May 21st, Mikhail Khrushchev reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On May the 22nd, Masanori Uchina reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
Again on May 22nd, Khadija El Kanabi reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On May the 26th, Scott Ferguson reported a non-group comet in stereo H1 images.
On May 29th, discovery of 2016 Ka Catalina announced.
On May the 30th, BOZU reported a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
May 31st, discovery of 2016 J3 P4/stereo announced.
On June the 2nd, Zijian Zhu reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On June the 3rd, BOZU reports a non-group comet in real-time C3 images.
And finally, on June the 4th, WOTOP Boompod reports a Kreutzer Group comet in real-time C3 images.
June the 5th, update. Okay, so this is the current comet magnitudes on observable regions for the current period. So we're going to kick off with Pan-STARRS 2013 X1, magnitude 6.5, steady, observable 45 degrees north to 90 degrees south, best observed in the morning. The last visual observation was in May of 2016.
Next we have 81P Veald, magnitude 11 and steady, 40 degrees north to 40 degrees south. Early morning, last seen in May.
Pan-STARRS 2014 S2, still magnitude 11, is beginning to fade a little bit. 50 degrees north to 35 degrees south, best in the evening. Last visual observation was 2016 May.
Next we have Pan-STARRS 2015 WZ, magnitude 12 and steady, 50 degrees north to 15 degrees south. It's an all-night object, last viewed again in May.
252P linear, 12 magnitude, fading, 50 degrees north to 55 degrees south. It's an all-night comet, last observed May 2016.
Next is Pan-STARRS 2014 W2, magnitude 12.5 and steady, 50 degrees north to 5 degrees north, an all-night object, last seen in May.
Next is 226P Pigott Linear Kowalski, 12.5 magnitude, question mark. It's a bright comet, 10 degrees south to 80 degrees south. It's a morning object, not yet observed.
Next is 9P Temple, magnitude 13 and steady, 30 degrees north to 60 degrees south, best viewed in the morning, and was last seen in September 2015.
53 Van Bisbuek, magnitude 13, question mark, steady, 35 degrees north to 65 degrees south, best in the evening, not yet observed.
Next is our old favourite, 29P Schraschmann-Vagman, magnitude 13, question mark, because it varies. 40 degrees north to 90 degrees south. It's best viewed in the morning and was last seen in October 2015.
And 116P Vilt, 13th magnitude, fading 35 degrees north to 80 degrees south. Best in the evening, last observed May 2016. Catalina 2013 US 10, magnitude 13, fading, poor elongation, last observed May 2016.
Lovejoy 2014 Q2, magnitude 13 with a big question mark, fading, observable from 50 degrees north to 35 south, best in the morning sky, and last seen in October 2015.
And finally, we have 77P Longmore, magnitude 14 and fading, observable 30 degrees north to 65 degrees south. That's an evening object and last observed in May 2016.
And that completes the current comet magnitudes and observable regions as of June 2nd. And now, thank you everybody for helping out with that. Just to, we come to the other part of the show that a lot of people like, the guests. So, would the guests like to introduce themselves?
Okay, I'm Rod Austin.
This is Terry Lovejoy from Brisbane. And that was Rod Austin from New Zealand. Sorry, Rod.
New Plymouth and New Zealand, yep.
And would our guests from Europe like to introduce themselves as well?
Hi, I'm Guy Wells from England.
And Daniel Bamberger from Germany.
Welcome, everybody. Now, Terry, could you just there's a couple of comets that are bright in your skies at the moment. Could you quickly quickly tell us about them?
We have C2013 Pan-STARRS, which is around about magnitude 6.5 to 7 at the moment, should brighten a little bit, maybe to around about magnitude 6 towards the end of the month. There's been some very nice photos actually of the comet taken the last couple of nights. I don't know if people have been looking at some of the images with the Helix Nebula and the comet.
Yes, I have seen those.
Beautiful, yes.
Really yes, fine image.
Yeah.
So that one will be heading a little bit further south. So obviously favouring the southern hemisphere. Although if you're in low northern latitudes, you'd probably get a reasonably good view of the comet as it's at high elongation. Apart from that one, the only other one I'm really aware of is a comet that hasn't really been confirmed from the ground yet. It was a comet found a couple of days ago in stereo images, and I know a couple of people are currently trying to confirm 2016 J3 in the evening sky. So that's another one to that we're going to keep our eye on. They're the main ones that I know about at the moment.
Great, and thanks, Terry. I know I have seen the images on Facebook already, so it is quite stunning. Rodney, can we have your input on it, please?
Well, I've been looking at the images. I've been quite impressed with the pictures of Pan-STARRS going past the Helix. One of the little ironies the other night, I was up at the New Plymouth Observatory and we were trying out our new 14-inch. And I said, well, you know, the Helix is over there, why don't we have a look? But unfortunately, the sky is just too bright in the middle of the city. Otherwise, we probably would have got the comet as well, which it would have been rather nice, but that's the way it goes. We've actually had a pretty rotten run of weather in the last few weeks after a phenomenal summer. And somebody flicked a switch and it just abruptly changed to thunderstorms and other ooh nasties. But, so I really haven't seen anything of recent weeks.
That's a shame.
Yeah, I know the feeling because most of the time here we've had baking hot days and then at night suddenly it clouds over. So my scopes have arrived from Europe finally. It's still boxed. My spotting scope, which I use with the camera for some imaging, is not really being used. So the weather is against us again, unfortunately. I think even you guys, which is unusual.
Mm.
Yes, we have the same problem in Europe. It's clouding over at night and very hazy.
We've had some clear nights here. Oh, have you tonight?
It's absolutely perfect, except it's just too windy to do anything with. It's a beautiful, transparent night outside.
So any clear nights we've had here of the haziness and the seeing have just been really bad, so it's been really difficult to do anything useful. How have you found it, Guy? Because I know you're not that far from me, but I've been finding it very frustrating recently.
Yeah, we've had a lot of haze here. Very difficult in London to do anything anyway, but the haze is compounding the problem.
Yeah.
Fortunately, we've done our first observations for almost 3 weeks yesterday, so we hope it will get better.
Oh, good.
I was going to say, particularly with the brighter comets, I know that, Guy, you've had some success in your area imaging them, is that correct?
A little bit of success. I mean, we can't even visually observe them from London with my scope, through the 6-inch, but we just about get a way of imaging them if they're bright enough.
So I've got a question here from the chat room. Has anyone asked Terry if he's on the verge of discovering the next Hale-Bopp?
Nice question.
I'd love to say yes, but no, I'm afraid.
Hiding behind the clouds.
Well, I just don't think they're there at the moment. I've actually had a reasonably good run this year. We had an unusually clear February and early March, which is unusual this time of year because it's normally cloudy and rainy. But there's just nothing there that I've found anyway so far. So I'll just keep looking. That's the way it is. We're coming into what's traditionally our clearer weather, which it runs June through to October, November. So hopefully we'll find something in the next few months, but you never know.
So this is a period where you hardly get any sleep.
Well, yeah, that too. to be honest, I don't know how, and Rod will probably talk you through this, but I don't know how I could possibly stay up all night visual comet hunting and then go to work the following day, particularly with a normal job. So luckily, most of my system is quite well automated, so I might need 15 minutes or so to set up, and then I might occasionally get up and check to see if everything is running okay. Sometimes I get some funny things happen with the control system and I have to reset the computer, so usually if I'm doing a morning search, I'll hop up, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and just check that everything's going okay and fix any problems. Is there any problems?
Yeah.
You're lucky. if we have to do most of our things manually, it's great to hear that there's a way to automate it. But you're really lucky.
It is. It's also very handy to have the observatory right next to the house, because I know the guys that have remote observatories sometimes have problems that they have to physically go to site to actually fix. And, you know, when they're in Chile, for example, that's a long trip.
Yeah.
But then on the same token, they have perfect skies up there.
Yeah, I think
so. That's a trade-off.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing when they for Teddy too. One of the guys I know who works with a remote telescope group, he's either flying to Chile or he's flying to the Canaries. So yeah, it gets to be fun, and of course a lot of the guys have pads in New Mexico as well. So it's a case of okay, we got a problem. I guess the air miles all add up in the end.
Yeah, if you're lucky, you've got somebody on site there that can actually troubleshoot the problem. But it's interesting, even in large observatories. I know, for example, Siding Spring, I was talking to one of the guys there, and they say even with the automation, there's still a need to have somebody there to fix problems with the large scopes. It was telling me one case that there's actually a 2.3-meter scope there, and the whole building rotates.
Nice.
Wow.
With a telescope, so not. So it's actually an amazing place. If you actually ever get a chance to visit the 2.3-meter ANU telescope at Siding Springs, it's worth having a look at. But they actually were, the telescope stopped tracking in the middle of the night, and the observers at the other end could not work out what was going on. And it turned out what they had done is actually spun the telescope around in the same direction to the point it actually reached the limit of the cable. Mm-hmm. So apparently it was designed to rotate 360 degrees in either direction, but not beyond that. Mm. So that they actually tracked it to the very end of the cable length. So the telescope basically stopped moving at that point. So, yeah, I guess sort of coming back to the original tale, it's sort of handy to have that observatory out next to the house. Mm. You can always fix problems.
Yeah.
Our observatory's only small, but I've lost count how many times I've had the cables get caught up and can't track any further. It's just so easy done, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think the other good thing is that, particularly with the equipment that we use as amateur astronomers, the mounts, I'm trying to remember the correct term that was used to me by this guy, the mount can flip so that you get to your final point, and then the whole scope moves and everything. There's a term for it, and I can't remember what the heck.
Zenith flip, isn't it?
That's it. Thank you, Mary.
Yeah, ours is always doing that, and then the cable starts getting tangled, and it's a nightmare.
But
one of the distinct advantages of the sort of observing I used to do was the fact that I stuck the telescope in the back of the car and took it up country and put it together, and no electrics, just all hand driven. Push there, push it up a bit, move it back. So you didn't have any of this problem with cables.
Yeah, there are times when I actually miss my EQ1 because it was just like you say, you point it, you move the scope around, and there you go, and you don't have all the electrical problems and cabling issues and tracking issues. So yeah, it's enjoyable doing it both ways, but
there's an answer to that, Mary. It's called Wi-Fi.
Actually, I have lots of problems when the humidity gets too high. I found that things like USB connections stop working properly, so you might get one image out of 10 will fail, or you know, something will not read. So I've tried just about everything and just can't. I've tried most of the connectors now on my equipment. I've got the gold plated connectors, but even when the humidity gets really high, even they don't do the job.
Now, I've been asked to ask Rodney a question. From the chat room, I said, I believe Rod is selling a lens or something he discovered his last comet with.
No, it's the 6-inch F8 lens that I discovered my first two comets with. It's a Jager's lens, and I've actually put it up on the market, but I've had no serious nibbles. I was actually wanting to sell it only within New Zealand because of the history with New Zealand, but Amos Sharma is interested in laying his hands on it for his comet hunting museum. He's got planned one of the many plans he has, and it would be quite nice to go there. But it's a matter of I've got a few bills I've got to settle, you see, and so I need the money for it.
That's always the same, isn't it?
I can't be too sentimental about it. I haven't actually used the lens since about 1987 or thereabouts. So the last comet I found with my Mead 8-inch, again, it's one of those pushback wisdom forwards things. It's like if you see on my the picture on my profile on Facebook, that's the one I actually found my last comet with. And that was a publicity shot taken for that comet, so I don't look anything like that now either.
Great. Thanks for clearing that up for us, Rodney, because I know that Neil can't be with us on the call, and he'd be asking that some of those questions. So, but he's getting them through to us. So,
you're right.
Yeah, it's good to have him involved remotely.
Yep.
Yes, it is. I was thinking when you said many problems there are with the big surveys and the technique involved. It must be a huge difference when you have a space telescope, and you can't simply go there and fix anything. It's impressive that anything works at that kind of level, because you just cannot fix anything.
No, it's amazing.
I'm always impressed that that issues with Kepler recently. And fixed that over the weekend, and the Rosetta spacecraft, which was in safe mode last weekend, and has been fixed also. I'm always impressed that it's possible to fix these issues.
I guess they must engineer it that way, because obviously you can't go there. So I don't understand how the technical stuff works, but just having the ability to fix it remotely like that, it must be absolutely essential for all of the probes and space telescopes, and you know, same with the Mars rovers. I mean, you need to be able to fix it if you have to from a remote location, and I think that engineering's amazing.
Yes, I'm often asked why the Mars rovers drive nearly 5 meters a day. But when you think about it, they have to think every move twice or 10 times, and if the rover flips over, they cannot fix it. So,
no, isn't it, you have to be very careful. Is it correct? There's a 20-minute delay with the Mars rovers. There's a kind of 20-minute lag for the data to get either direction. So if you see it approaching an obstacle, you need to plan ahead quite severely. Otherwise, like you say, it will tip over and that's the end of it. So, yeah, it must be frustrating watching it moving that slowly. But, yeah, you can see why they have to.
Yes, usually they program a tour for one day, and at the end of the day, they get an answer if the rover did what they had planned. And if there was any kind of problem, the rover just stopped and asked, what should I do? And they lost the whole day. So it's frustrating sometimes. And of course, the same thing with all space probes.
Having said that, I'm sure they've run a lot longer than the original mission.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody was telling me that the SOHO mission was only designed for 18 months. That was 1995, 96 that went up, and it's still operating now.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I think it speaks for the actual technology that we were employing at that point. As I've said in other shows, when you consider that Voyager was built on using transistors, no integrated circuits, as we have in our phones today, it's purely straightforward transistors. So it survived that long and it's still working even on the edge of the solar system. So yeah, it's brute strength engineering, and that's probably why we are doing so well, is because as much as the new stuff, all these integrated processors are good for CubeSats and stuff, but when you get into, you're talking about something that's going to a comet or it's going out of the solar system eventually, you need a good old-fashioned rugged proven technology, and Voyager and Pioneer have shown us that. Yeah, it 1950s and 1960s transistors work very well, thank you, even in 2016.
Yes.
Fail-proof technology.
Nick, you mustn't have read that Voyager 2 crashed into the edge of the universe.
Oh, yes. Yes, reported about that.
Well, I heard it's actually...
Must be going faster than I thought.
Yeah, I heard it's actually sneaking through a wormhole to come back in the 23rd century. Get rid of us carbon-based infestations.
Yeah, that was Star Trek, wasn't it?
Star Trek the Motion Picture, yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing how that gets into a conversation about comets and stuff.
Oh, it has to. It has to.
But no, but seriously, Rosetta was built with cutting-edge technology then. It was put into storage. Then it was finally launched, and it's just showing you just how good that tech is. People say, oh, well, it's out of date. It isn't out of date. When you're sending something into space that's going to be doing a long trip, something like New Horizons, like Juno, like anything like that, you've got to look at how survivable the technology is. It's intense cold, it's intense heat, it's radiation, and at the end of the day, when it gets there, it's got a function. And we're seeing more and more that the old technology is proving to be the best technology. Everybody says, well, hey, well, we can send a mass of CubeSats to Jupiter. Yeah, we can do that. They're built around mobile phone technology. But can that technology survive the rigors of space and of the journey and then function 100%?
I've never had a mobile phone that works for more than 18 months, so I think the answer to that is no.
Yeah. How fast can they get to Jupiter? That's the question. Yeah. Well, New Horizons got there in 13 months, so it'll be fine.
But the thing is, though, it's still got a lot of rigors to face. We're seeing this with Rosetta. The main probe and Philae have shown us that the technology, how good and how strong the technology really needs to be. The fact that poor Phil A fell into a gully and wasn't able to completely recharge means we have to look at technology, maybe go back to using the plutonium batteries that we sent out on Voyager for this type of mission. Because obviously you can't always, it's very, very difficult to control a landing in on a comet nucleus. Because if I don't know how many of you have actually played the little comet lander game that Rosetta put out. It was fiendishly difficult. You've got to hit it just right, you've got to slow it right down, and you've got to do it just right. Otherwise, you just bounce off.
It's amazing that it actually got to work at all. I mean, Philobot was not a complete failure.
No, it wasn't, because it did some of the experiments.
And we have loads of data from it,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
But I think what we have to do, if we're going to do a mission like Rosetta again, maybe we'd have to say, yeah, okay, so we give it the same power plant as we gave Voyager as a backup. And then hopefully it will be able to completely fulfill its mission. I'm really surprised they didn't do that. We've proven we can safely launch probes with this nuclear power technology.
Well, you have to remember Rosetta is a European spacecraft, and the supply of radio isotopes is not very, very large. It's expensive and difficult to include in the spacecraft.
Well, I think what we're finding is these type of missions, and I'm are going to be joint agencies. I would like to see? I would like to see Australia and New Zealand reopen Woomera and launch probes from there. Because we had a very good launch site back in the... Terry's probably going to say I'm showing my age, which I probably am. But back when we were in Britain and Australia were cooperating in space launch technology with Black Knight, we were launching cutting-edge stuff. We put Prospero into orbit from Woomera, and it's still there. Prospero is still talking. If you've got a receiver, you can still pick up Prospero. And I guess that really tells you just how good things were even back in the 60s and 70s. We may not have been NASA.
There was talk about opening up Cape York for launching satellites because of its location near the equator. But I don't know what happened to that. I think the funding just wasn't there and there wasn't the infrastructure. Those types of things, yeah. I think, fell through. But there's some ideal locations there that they could launch. Obviously near the equator, that there's actually you already have an additional amount of velocity that you can use to reach orbit, so there's less energy required to actually get up into an orbit.
That's why the European Space Agency has Kourou in French Guiana.
Yes.
Because it's convenient, it's on the equator, and it's the perfect place to put up satellites and do resupply. To be honest, if we are gonna go do a manned mission, Terry and Rodney have heard me go on about this before, and says Mary, to a comet, that would be the perfect place to launch it. Yes, yeah. Let's use something nice and big, rocket-wise, something like the Sun of Saturn V or something. Use SLS. Send it from Kourou. Because all from Australia, because that way it's got the added advantage of being on the equator. We can build better. We can not worry a little bit too much more about weight. Because that's the big thing, isn't it? At the end of the day, weight.
When it is, yeah.
Yes.
So we can use Australia, we can use French Guiana, and we would actually have a heck of an advantage. I'm really surprised the rest of the world hasn't woken up to it yet.
Actually, I know this is a show about comets, but Has anyone seen the SpaceX footage, the landing? That's amazing.
Absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
We need more visionaries like Elon Musk and similar people who just think outside the box.
Absolutely.
I think what we need to do to get the missions we want to more comets, to the asteroid belt, we need to perhaps ditch the idea that Cape Canaveral or Vandenberg is the best place to launch. We need to start looking at some of the other places we use, because then we can look at building probes that are heavier than normal, but are more packed with instruments, maybe sharing technology, so we can use radioisotope power supplies aboard and have fun and do some really good science. I bet I hope certain people aren't listening, because I'm going to say this. I bet if we'd have built Rosetta that way and built Philae that way, we'd be reeling the data in still.
I think if Rosetta would have been planned with nuclear battery, it would never have launched. I think the funding would have been impossible.
I have to disagree with that, Daniel, because I think we're in an age now where a space mission doesn't just belong to one country. It's perhaps a big international collaboration. Maybe you've got three or four space agencies involved. And doing it that way, we can not only share technology, we can cut costs. If it's just one space agency that's footing the bill for, say, something like Sirius X, RX, going to an asteroid sample and coming home, then it's just going to be expensive. It's not going to be doable. But if, say, you've got NASA, ESA, Roscosmos, JAXA, and everybody else chipping in funds, that's how ESA does it. Because it's not just one nation footing the bill for the project. Every nation puts in a certain amount of funding. And that way, that's the only reason we can probably have afforded such a mission to 69P. Was because we
did. I will be happy to be proven wrong. I will be happy to see it. Let's see if it happens. I mean, the way ESA does it is great, because they join the efforts of several nations and of NASA and ESA and perhaps JAXA and Roscosmos. If they all work together, let's see what they can do.
Personally, I would like to see us going to other comets. I know that my favourite is always going to be Hawley. I'd love to see a Rosetta style mission to Hawley's comet.
It will be some time to chance.
Well, we got plenty of time to plan for it.
Yeah,
actually, one
be great.
One mission I would like to see is a mission to an actual new comet, not a a periodic comet, simply because you would actually be seeing something pristine. Of course, the problem with a new comet is planning.
Just have to discover it 15 years in advance, and that's really difficult.
So maybe it's one of those missions, a longer-term mission, where you wait for an opportunity, have enough fuel that you can change the orbit to intercept. But I think we would see something completely new. I think if we went to a first time comet.
That's why I will be really happy about the New Horizons flyby of that KBO object. Because I think that's the closest what you will have ever seen to a new comet. It's a really pristine object.
And of course, if we're going to do that type of mission, with the new ion drive that we're using, beginning to use now for some of these trips, the amount of fuel you actually, the amount of propellant you need on board is much smaller than it used to be. With Voyager, we used the planets, and we were doing a whole series of flybys to actually accelerate or deaccelerate when needed. So we may not actually be that locked down on how many maneuvers we can do, particularly if we say we go to Comet A. We know that Comet A is worth having a good look at, so we set up a mission, we go there, because we're using the ion drive, the ion drive, which is using I think xenon gas or something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then we can go there, we can perhaps orbit for a while, do the science there, and then we can actually look at saying, okay, Comet B is completely out of the blue, where is it in regards to Comet A? Yeah, we can do this, and then we can just send it off to look at that. And maybe that's the future of comet science, is we have maybe a series of space probes parked somewhere out near Jupiter, perhaps even waiting for an interesting object. And Jupiter is always capturing new comets or changing the orbits, certainly changing the orbits of new comets. So we might actually have a better opportunity if we use Jupiter as a staging post.
I guess the orbital mechanics wouldn't be quite as complicated if you're not doing all those gravity assists.
Yeah. Once you get there, you sit there, you can use the probe for other science. Jupiter is going to be a subject of interest for a very long time. So is Saturn, because it has its own mini solar system, so to speak.
Yes.
So you can have an instrument parked out there. It can be looking at the whole Jovian system or the Saturnian system. Then you get your comet coming in. Then you can say, hey, this new comet, the spectra reading is unusual. Can we go look at it? Yes, we can, because we're already a big chunk of the distance there.
With the Large Synoptic Telescope survey due, I think they're talking probably 2020-ish, and even the current Pan-STARRS survey, if we were to, if a large Hale-Bopp size comet or even something smaller was on its way in, we have a good chance of discovering something like that at least 10 years out.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to remember that comets like Hale-Bopp are still observable. So 20 years after they passed through the inner solar system, they are still observable. So it would have been possible to discover it perhaps 10 years in advance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe this is a reason to get people like yourself, Terry, like Rob McNaught, back into serious business using sighting springs for the Southern Observatory, as a Southern Observatory, and mirroring the image in the northern skies, because then we can look for these objects. We can then go to the space agency, say, look, we know this is coming. Can we do this? Can we go there? We have very little knowledge, really, of comets from space probe missions. We got very, very lucky with Hawley back in 86.
Oh, yes, we had several probes there, which is amazing.
We had the Scalarup mission, which was great. We've got Rosetta.
We had Deep Impact, which had two comets.
So
not just one.
We really, really do need it, and I know Terry and I are on the same page. We need a survey of our own. Everybody, we have the big surveys, Catalina, Pan-STARRS. We need all the comet observers, both in both hemispheres, really talking to each other, setting up a network, saying, okay, this comet's coming in my skies, is coming into your sky soon. Can you pick up? We've been there before, haven't we, Terry?
Yeah. I just need an 8-meter telescope. That...
Yeah, I can imagine it now. I can see the newspapers in your locale. 8-meter telescope going in. World renowned comet observer Terry Lovejoy builds the biggest known observatory, and I can just see that someone in the north saying, "Okay, we've got to do that now."
it's been in the newspapers. Now it has to be done.
Yeah, you wouldn't be putting that in the back of the car and driving to a dark sky site.
As I say, maybe that is the future for amateur astronomers, amateur comet hunters, observers, is that we all band together and we pass over comets for continued observation. We're the only people that can do that. We have the instruments, we have the time. If you're using a professional instrument, a lot of the time, unless it's quiet, which it never is, the Palomar's never quiet. The Chile telescopes are never quiet. They're always booked completely up. And I think this is where a lot of professionals really, really do get envious of us, because we can go out night after night after night, weather permitting, and we can just follow through on a series of observations. They have to put proposals. They have to get grants to pay for their telescope time. And this is probably why the PACA programs have done so well, is because we, the amateur astronomy community, is feeding into the professional network. We are learning, we are picking up all the nuances and passing information on to the professionals, and we're making the discoveries. And I think that's the greatest thing about it. We have this ability to be in the right place at the right time.
Well, talking about that, how are you going with your 16-inch rod?
Well, of course, 6 months ago we moved house, didn't we? And so currently it is sitting behind a pile of boxes and a whole lot of stuff out in the shed. I can't even get at it. mind you, I have been working on this telescope since 2006, and good things take time, you know.
Yep.
So, eventually.
Now, I've got to thank you, Rod, for discovering three really nice comets back in the 1980s. Just wanted to personally thank you. Actually, your first one, and I still remember the original designation, 1982G.
Yep.
That's right, wasn't it? G, yes.
That's correct, yes. It was which in my opinion is the finest comet ever, so it's Grace House, guys.
I'll tell you what.
You can only find your first comet once.
That was a beautiful find. We actually had reasonably dark skies here back then, and actually the one memory I have was that one night I got up, had a look at it, and at that time the tail hadn't been that distinct, and I got up that morning and I quickly looked in the binoculars, and I could see this obvious tail just pointing out, to the upper right, about 3 degrees long. We just had a tail flare or some sort of tail activity on that morning that made it appear a lot brighter. Yep. And that was really nice. It was the first comet I'd seen that I could see with the naked eye as well.
It was actually quite an interesting sort of beast, and the whole process of discovering it was really quite strange, because I'd taken the the old 6-inch up country, and it was blowing a little bit of a stiff breeze, and the telescope was wobbling everything. It was a dreadful mounting it was on. It was a horrible thing to use, and it was all I could do was scan vertically, and I got it almost at the top of the scan, only about the elevation of about, I don't know, 40 degrees, and so I was very lucky I found it at all, and I was so unsure of what I'd found that when I got home and dragged out various charts and so on like that, the photographic charts I had, and realised I actually had a comet, I was living at home with the folks at the time, and I really didn't want to go to the phone and report the jolly thing at 4 o'clock in the morning and then wake them all up. So I left a note for my mother to wake me up when she got up to feed the cats. And so at 8 o'clock in the morning she came and she thought I had an accident. And she, as I sat up in bed, I was white as a sheet, and I said, "Well, I think I found a comet." So I rang Mount John Observatory and so on like that. But the funny thing is that I got a telegram from Peter Birch from the Perth Observatory about 3 days later, saying he'd been up chasing bloody comets, because the word had got out, and it hadn't come to me. I hadn't actually heard the official confirmation that it actually had been confirmed.
Oh, really?
Before the rest of the world knew about it. That's the first thing I knew on the Monday morning. So it was a bit of a strange one, but it was pretty good to get that. It sort of made it obvious I could actually discover comets. And, of course, then 2 years later, I got my second one. So, yeah, it was the same telescope, but it was a different configuration.
That was an interesting find. That was already visible to the naked eye, from memory.
Yeah, that's right. I got the magnitude entirely wrong on that one. I thought it was about a magnitude 7 or something, and in fact it was actually 5.5. I mean, it was so obvious. I mean, the moment I got onto the thing, it was only the third occasion I'd ever used the telescope in that configuration, and I wasn't entirely sure how to take it apart and put it in the back of the car to get back down to get a phone. And it was a very strange situation, because we'd had all this rotten weather and the sudden clear night, so I went out and found this jolly thing, and in actual fact, I started the night by observing periodic comet Clark, and it was found by a friend of mine who I used to work with at Mount John, and he found it on the night. I was comet hunting on the night off, but anyway, this particular night, this was on a second return, and I looked at that first, and because of that, I actually missed what became periodic comet, I can't remember the name of it now, it was one of the Japanese ones anyway, but 2 hours later I had this other one, and it was so bright, it filled half the field of the telescope, and you could see the thing moving, it was going so fast.
Wow.
And yet I instinctively looked to see where Omega Centauri was, because I thought, it's a globular, and it was the only globular in the sky that would be even remotely like it, but it was miles away, you know, so it was away in the just out on its own and just motoring along. I was doing something about 12 degrees a day. It's actually that was when I found it.
That was what I remembered too, because I'd actually heard word of it. And I think you must have sent through a single observation or a set of observations from that one night, because yeah. I had the positions. I got up and had a look, couldn't find anything, but I hadn't counted on it moving 12 degrees, so I was looking in the wrong part of the sky. And then the following day, I think it was David Sargent said it was about magnitude 5.5.
You don't get these stories, do you? So I love these stories. You don't get these with the big sky surveys. There's something really just cool about these home-discovered comets. I love hearing how it's happened and what happened next. It's not just a computer going, oh, ping, there's something in this picture that wasn't in the other. It's much cooler.
Well, cool was the word, too, boy. The night I found it was an extremely cold night, and the windscreen had frozen solid, and I was actually driving down the Carrington Road is about a distance of about 16 kilometres from home, and I drove down the road. My head stuck out the window, so I could see. And I was just sort of steering down this twisting road. My head stuck out. I tell you, I was frozen all the time I got home. But yes, it was the. They were odd one. There was always every one I've found has had its own peculiarities of the way it was discovered and so on. But that was the most obvious one. I mean, that was a comet. I knew I had it instantly. I saw it. It was so obvious. But it really didn't turn out to be much. And I only ever saw it on about three occasions anyway.
I got a really memorable view of that. Comet just before it disappeared, and it was right down in the eastern sky, and we were looking at it through a 16-inch scope, and the amount of detail you could see in the tail was just amazing. It was obviously an iron tail, but you could see all the little filaments in the tail, and it was almost on the horizon, and really was that was probably the single sight I remember most about it. And of course your next one was an interesting one too, Rod.
Over-publicised. Oh gosh, it's going to be the next best thing to Comet Cahotic.
It still did better than Ison, yeah. Though
Yes, at least it didn't fall to pieces, yes. Yes. Good for a laugh. Yeah. But I got a nice free trip to the United States out of that, and it was quite interesting. One of the real wacky things that came out of it, I gave a talk with David Levy to a science convention, high school kids and so on, and afterwards the kids came up and asked my autograph, and what? I mean, I've never been asked for an autograph before. it's a very strange situation. I mean, what the heck? It's just me, after all, you know. That was quite entertaining all around.
Guy, do you do much comet hunting yourself? And obviously we all see your amazing images of, you know, minor bodies and comets and stuff. But what do you guys do at North Holt?
Well, mainly asteroids, but yeah, we image and get the positions of comets. I mean, yesterday we were, what was the comet? 2014 W2, we were imaging last night.
Right.
Yeah, we did not yet measure the images, so I cannot tell you where it is or what it is, but we got it. It's pretty, I've seen it, it's pretty nice. So I think we do about one-third comets, two-thirds asteroids.
Right.
I think that's it. We suffer from heavy light pollution in close to London. And it's terrible. But I think it's part of the fun, because if we can do it from there, then you can do it from everywhere else. It's really nice. We do it for. We've started in August 2015, so we're a really young observatory, and we do it everything our own. So nothing remotely, nothing automatically. It's everything done ourselves. So I think that's part of the fun. We cannot do as much as the surveys. But I think Guy and myself, we remember every object we ever imaged. So none of the surveys can say that.
No.
What
equipment do you have?
Apart from Hale-Bopp.
Good. Yeah, that's true. I was actually living not far from North Holt when Hale-Bopp was visible in the skies. I remember the frustration of the light pollution from that area, but Hale-Bopp was amazing.
Yeah,
you would have sent it quite easily there, Mary.
Yeah, definitely.
We have a small telescope, a 6-inch Cass grain, so only a small one, but we can do quite something. I think asteroids are possible to magnitude 20. And yeah, it's nice to do.
It is. I mean, your pictures are amazing. I thought you had a much bigger telescope than you do.
No, it's really small. So some of our images have been taken with a 70-millimeter telescope.
Actually, yes, sure.
Yeah, it's a baby. And well,
what camera are you using?
Guy,
we have the CCD. It's an Atik 4140X.
Okay.
Fairly
that sensitive. Helps.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
Guy.
Terry, you're still using are you using a CCD camera, or are you still using a how is it called?
The DSLR.
Yeah, are you still using that?
No, I've used a CCD camera for 6 years now, actually. I ended up, I needed, particularly during the summer here, I was getting so many hot pixels and defects in the images, and I decided to go with a Curl CCD camera. And it's also giving me more limiting magnitude as well, going that way.
Yes. We started working with a DSLR, and it was really amazing starting with a CCD, because suddenly the limiting magnitude was blown off, and it really was a new universe. Suddenly.
Yeah. Having said that, the DSLR is pretty impressive still. I remember when I first got the Canon, the 300D, and I just stuck it on a tripod and pointed it with the standard lens up to the sky, and you know, the you could see magnitude 10, magnitude 11 stars on the in the image, and I thought that was just remarkable.
Well, a couple of summers ago, I was tracking Vesta and Ceres just with a standard lens on an SLR night after night when they were quite close to Mars. You know, and you could clearly see the movement of the two objects relative to the background, but that was only a short exposure just with a standard SLR lens. And I think digital cameras, they must be the biggest revolution in astronomy since the invention of the telescope, I think.
Yes, they certainly are. I think what's possible for amateur observers with a small telescope, I mean, it would not have been possible 20 years ago. It's just amazing. Which means how important work amateur astronomers can do.
Yeah.
Well, I think every time I do a talk to a group of people, I'm always kind of drumming home that I don't know any other hobby. Well, I class this as a hobby for myself, but where there's so much pro-am collaboration, you just don't get that in any other hobby, not to this degree anyway, which I think is amazing, because you're actually contributing to something as well as having fun and doing pretty photography and seeing interesting things. And that, you know, that is really important.
Yes, Guy, I think that's the whole motivation to contribute to something that feels important, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. It's,
and you gotta have fun. Don't forget having fun. It's a hobby too.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
It's fun, but it's both, because you can do something that you don't just enjoy yourself, but that feels important. It's really great. I would love to see more people doing comets or asteroids and not just deep space observations, because there are so many astrophotographers who do great deep space observations of nebulae and galaxies, but there are very little who really contribute to what the Minor Planet Center does. And I would love to see more people doing that, because it's possible with cheap and small equipment.
And I think part of the problem could be sometimes a lack of understanding of what your limiting magnitude is for your equipment, because I mean we have six telescopes. We've got a 10-inch Dobb and an 8-inch Ritchie Crescian, and yet I look at magnitude comets that are 14, I think I'll never get that, there's no point trying because it's just too faint. And it actually isn't. If I was to actually try, I'm sure I'd get them. And that's probably a part of the problem, is these things are very faint, they're very difficult to find, and people might just think that they're too faint for their equipment, when the reality is they probably aren't.
Yes, I mean, visually, you can do, what can you do with the 6-inch, perhaps magnitude 13, and that would overexpose our CCD sensor. So we cannot do magnitude 13 objects because they're too bright.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a difference if you observe visually through your telescope, which of course is fun and can be great. But it's a real difference if you use a sensitive CCD. The limiting magnitude is just way off that which you may read in the manual of your telescope. I mean, sometimes they write limiting magnitude 13.3, but of course that's for visual observations, and that's not what you ask for if you do imagery.
Long exposure imaging, you're going to pick up a lot fainter stuff.
But I think also part of the problem is a lot of people don't understand imaging techniques.
Well, but you can learn this. I mean, it's about reading and staying and keep doing. I mean,
I think talking to some of the people I've spoken to, it's to them imaging is kind of like witchcraft, because you've got people like Damien Peach, Terry, who are putting stunning images up onto the internet of objects, and they people just don't realise that with a little bit of study and tinkering with your own equipment, you can actually get there yourself. They've gotten so used to seeing Damien's work, I think. That they get to the point where I can't do that. But it's just a case of applying yourself.
What I found is that a lot of people tend to overprocess images. It's one thing I've noticed with people like Damien Peach. His photos look very natural. They're not, the colours are subtle, the contrast is subtle, but you can see he's one of those people who has the knack of bringing out a lot of the faint detail without actually over processing the image. So he's definitely got that
touch.
But his attention to detail is phenomenal, though. I mean, if he's going to be imaging, his telescope's wrapped in ice packs all day, and you know the level of detail that he goes to get good quality data in the first place is way beyond what most people would do. So that's why his stuff is amazing. But it's post-processing is like a real dark art, isn't it? And that's what makes the difference. And that is just about practice and just doing it over and over again and just trying to get better each time.
Yeah.
I think the thing is, though, a lot of people have got used to the false color images that are put up on things like on the APOD pages and stuff like that, because they're not used to seeing the real colours, because they're using false colours to bring out certain bits of information, and those pictures get put up as part of the briefing. Say this is where your tax dollars are going. We're looking at XYZ. This is the image. They're kind of expecting that. They're not expecting to see the real colours in a nebula or the real colours in a comet. They're so used to seeing an image that's been taken at specific wavelengths for a specific reason. That's what they're expecting to see. I think that's part of the problem. There's an expectation, and it's not a realistic expectation.
Yes, but I sometimes get asked because people hear that in reality these nebulae are black and white. And they ask me, are they really black and white, and are they just added colors to make it more beautiful or something like this? And I say, if you look at them visually, your eyes don't quite see the colors, but if you take photos, you will see the color, and it's really there, and you can get it. And you don't need much equipment. You don't even have to be. You don't even have to be Damien Peach to get a great image of Jupiter or the Orion Nebula. I've seen.
No two people ever process images in the same way, so you kind of develop your own style. And I think when I first started, I was thinking, well, mine doesn't look like this person's image. What have I done wrong? And the answer is nothing. Yeah, so, and this is what I always do in my astrophotography talks. I tell people not to take much notice of what other people are putting online. Look at your own work and look at your own improvement from your old images and just, you know, make it your own style and your own journey, and don't be constantly comparing yourself to other people's work.
Yeah, of course, there's something like quality in images, which can be judged perhaps a bit objectively, but the style of the image is not to be the same in two occasions.
I think one of the greatest thing is because Terry's on the net, and we have groups like Comet Watch on Facebook. We can get good feedback. I know occasionally, if I'm using certain telescopes, I'll put up a black and white image, a monochrome image of a comet, particularly if someone's asking, the collaborations are asking for all images possible. I'll go and use a telescope that's only offering monochrome. And you can quite often see very subtle changes in the tail that way. And it's kind of nice when people like yourself, Terry, and everybody else chips in and makes comments and says, well, try doing this, because that way you learn. And I think that's perhaps the greatest thing we have. Is the fact
that I mean, the online astronomy community is amazing. Everyone is so supportive and so helpful of each other if you ask. So, you know, it's really good.
Yes, anybody who wants to start doing this, the online communities would be really helpful to learn not only the basics, but on every step. I mean, even the best astronomer photographers could learn certain stuff in these communities. And still get some input to try new things. That's great, because you can contribute to the learning of others and see how they evolve, how their images evolve over time. And it's fun to see not only your own images improve, but also the images of somebody else. And
So what kind of processing do you do on your asteroid images? Because I know I've seen inverted versions of them, because you can often see faint things better that way. But
yeah, well, we use a software called Astrometrica, which right. which does this quite naturally. It's it can be done automatically, and so it's the standard software to do measurements on comets and asteroids, and also on some transients like supernovae, which can be observed with similar equipment. And it's not that much of a fancy processing work. It's they're monochrome, of course. You want to get the data. It's not so much about getting beautiful images in the first place, but about getting the data. You can get beautiful images from things to post on the internet from the same images, but to get the data is that can be done on parallel. You can do similar. You can do different things with the same images.
Okay, we're actually approaching 1.5 hours for the show already, so we're going towards one of those shows. I'm going to ask everybody. I'm going to go around and ask what projects are you working on right now, and what techniques are you using? So we start with Terry, please.
What am I doing at the moment? Well, I'm actually going through a process of rewriting the software that I use to actually scan images. So that's taking up a fair bit of my time at the moment. So I want to make the software smarter and faster, and make a few other improvements as well.
What platform is it on, Terry?
It's C#.
C#.
So I'm moving it from C#, and I'm using a program called Source Extractor, which the Source Extractor actually takes the image and converts into a catalog of stars and objects that is detected in that image, and I have some ideas that improve that process. So I'm actually going to take Source Extractor out of it and do it all within my program. And I'm also looking at a better processing pipeline in the software to make it run faster. At one stage, I had tried SkySift, which is one of the which is probably the main comet finding asteroid finding software out there. It's used by probably half of the amateurs, the serious amateurs. I tried it a few years ago, but it was fairly slow on my images, and so I ended up not going with SkySift and doing my own software. But I have a feeling that there's been quite a few improvements made in SkySift. But the other thing, I guess, for me is it's more on the journey. So it's more one of my interests is the actual building and configuration of the survey. So, I never had any real intention to go out there and just buy all of the bits and just have somebody else do that all for me.
Yeah.
And part of my interest is actually to put together a system, do a lot of the work to develop it. I think I've probably got a bit more satisfaction out of doing it that way. And of course, there's a lot of luck involved.
and then we'll all be saying, "Okay, Terry, can we please use your software?"
Yeah, the thing is, it takes so much time to develop this stuff. Mm. There's one thing. One thing is to actually, and I have thought about that. It's one thing to write something that you can use, but it's another thing to actually write something that will work for other people, will work with their telescopes or work with their cameras. I think there's a huge amount of development. And I'm not a developer by trade, although I work with developers and that sort of thing. And I've learnt computer programming over the years. But I'm no expert at it, that's for sure. And I kind of realised how much work is involved in putting together, you know, a software package. You know, it really is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it might, isn't it?
Yeah, it might. If I was to do this all by myself, it would probably, I'd probably need 1,000 hours, you know, to put together a software package that I could use, but it would probably require 5,000 hours to write something that other people can use as well. But, you know, who knows?
Rodney, what's going on with you?
Well, of course, because all my telescopes are all buried behind stuff in the shed, I'm not actually doing any observing. I haven't actually for quite some time. I'm a very lazy individual. But what I am getting involved with is with the new telescope at the New Plymouth Observatory, and I'm hoping to get stuck into doing DSLR photometry of, believe it or not, asteroids, which is actually my interest from way back when I worked at Mount John, but also with comets too. But that's a little bit down the track. We've only just had the telescope installed. It's just up and running. So there's a lot of I'm just part of a team working on that. And so I'm hoping to do something, get a crack at that. Until such times as we finally build our new home, which we're hoping to do within the next 8 months. And then maybe I can get back into a bit of a visual observing as well. But at the moment, you know, the time's ticking along, and I'm getting no younger.
Yeah. Great. Thanks. Thank you, Rodney. Guy, your turn.
Well, mainly it's asteroids and comets at the Northrop Grumman Observatory, but I also run astronomy group in West London. So we just try to promote astronomy here, and the light pollution, and that's what we mainly contend with.
Daniel.
Yeah. It's similar. Well, I'm working with Guy, and I'm building up the observatory and trying to get used to the stuff we do. I mean, we do it for 9 months now, and are still learning a lot, and making progress slowly. And I'm working on some ways to automate some of the planning and target selection, that kind of stuff, and trying to predict what targets are possible, what are not. On the other hand, as Guy mentioned, we have this this group from London, Northrop Branch Astro, which does astronomy in London and mainly that area. And we help people improving their imaging skills and what we talked about earlier in here. And also trying to get the public involved in stuff that happens. We have the Mercury transit in May, where Guy and others from the group were putting on telescopes, so others were able to to look through and see the stuff themselves. So we try to involve as many people as possible and get them interested in astronomy.
Right.
That's what we do.
And Mary, your turn.
Well, a couple of things that we've got ongoing. We've recently bought a spectrometer, so well, Mark's been trying to get that working. Fortunately, we had Hugh Allen came to Banbury and did a spectroscopy workshop recently, so we've got pages and pages of notes to work from trying to get that up and running. We're also having a major technical problem with our ASI camera, just crashing every laptop we try and capture data with. So we're trying to, probably going to have to build a bare bones laptop that has nothing really non-essential running on it. So we can try and get that working, because we've got a lovely piece of equipment that I've done some really nice imaging with in the past, which now just will not stay connected without crashing. So we've had a lot of technical problems, and we also had an issue with our batteries not charging properly, because everything in our observatory is trickle charged by solar panels. And so we did go out to do some imaging on the one of the few good nights we had, and all the batteries were dead. So it's been just a big headache with everything we've tried to do recently. So we're hoping that, you know, we can get that up and running. But of course, it's not to Lucent Cloud season now, and they're one of my favourite things. So I'll be spending a lot of time out at unsocial hours trying to spot those. So a few things going on.
Right. One final question for everybody. Dome or runoff roof shed? Which one do you think is the best?
What was the question? Sorry?
Dome or a dome, a standard dome that rotates with the scope, or a runoff, a shed where the roof rolls backwards?
Runoff roof.
Yeah.
Runoff roof. Okay.
Currently,
our
observatory doesn't even have a roof. There you go.
but we have a shed. It puts the wind outside.
I said domes are a curse. We've got a small dome for our new 14-inch, and it's a real curse of a thing that you have to keep an eye out the whole time, because track something across the meridian, you've got to turn the dome through about 270 degrees suddenly as it goes across the meridian. The sliding roof is much easier to work with. You don't have that problem, except that it's less comfortable.
Well, I'm going to thank everybody for joining us this month. Please do keep us up to date with your projects. We want to know what's going on. So I'm going to say thank you, Terry, Rodney, Guy, Daniel, thank you for joining us, Mary. I know
thank
we've
you.
All missed Neil, but
it's a pleasure.
Hopefully he'll be back next month with us for the July show. So I'm going to say thank you very much. Good night, good afternoon, good morning. And everybody have a great time. Clear skies, everyone.
Thank you. Bye,
good
everyone.
Good morning now.
morning.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts. AFM.